It is not easy to get from Los Angeles to Wichita, Kansas, but we took a trip out there not too long ago to meet the guy who runs the second biggest privately held company in the United States and is, oh, by the way, the fifth richest person in America.
This is about the quietest corner office I've ever seen.
Well, it's not a corner office. That's the thing.
No, it's not. That's true. That's true.
No, they said, well, where are you, the new building, where do you want to be? I said, I want to be in the middle, not on the top. Most of them are on the top. Why? Then you just isolate yourself.
Charles Koch is the CEO of Koch Industries, a company that was founded 75 years ago, making its name in oil and gas, then expanding to produce everything from toilet paper to Stainmaster carpet. It's grown to 100,000 employees in more than 60 countries, but it all started small, with Charles Koch's father, Fred. Charles and his brother David took the company over when their dad Fred died in 1961. It's worth about $21 million back then. Today, Forbes has it at $115 billion with a B. In his new book, Good Profit, Charles Koch talks about the strategies he used to guide such incredible growth, the current business landscape in America, and also the thing that has turned him into a household name the past 10 or 15 years or so, politics. So we sat down with Mr. Koch in his office at Koch Industries headquarters out in Wichita for what is one of the most in-depth interviews the elusive billionaire has ever given. It is this installment of Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Charles Koch, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
There you are, Boston, Massachusetts, 1961. A couple of graduate degrees from MIT. And you come back to Wichita, Kansas. Why?
Well, I was working for a consulting firm back there, which was then one of the leading consulting firms, Arthur D. Little, and I was learning a lot, and it was a great place to be when you're single, all the girls' schools there, and they had jazz bars. I mean, it was terrific. I loved it. And so my father starts calling me, urging me to come back to Wichita, and I remember what it was like growing up under him. Like starting at age six, he had me working virtually all my spare time. And I don't mean doing easy stuff. Like he started out at age six digging dandelions at a 100-degree temperature. And I'm thinking, why did my father hate me and all my friends' fathers love him because they're out swimming and having a great time and here I am.
So he was tough, your old man was.
So he was tough. Yeah, one of his, well, his philosophy was this. He said, I don't want my sons to be country club bums.
Huh. Here you are, almost 80 years old, right? 1st of November?
Yeah.
You're working in the company your father founded or built. His picture's over there. Big portrait.
That's right, absolutely.
There's a bust of him out in the hallway, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there's the letter from him.
Yeah.
I refer to around the corner.
Tell us about that letter, because that says a lot about your dad and about you.
Yeah, well, that was terrific. On his death, I opened a safety deposit box and I found that. He wrote that letter in 1936 when he was 36, and I was one. There were just two of us alive then, because I have an older brother who's 2 years older than I am. And he said in that letter that he had given us each an insurance policy to pay for our education. And we could either use that to develop and learn to make a contribution, or we could squander it. And if we squander it, it'll ruin our lives, and we will never experience what he called the glorious feeling of accomplishment.
Still a factor in your life, then, your dad?
Well, yeah, because he taught me the basic values that guide our company, guide everything I do.
The book is called Good Profit, in which you talk about entrepreneurship that is principled. How do you do that in this economy today?
Well, I mean, it's not easy because the economy is so riddled with corporate welfare and anti-competitive regulations, anti-innovation regulations, regulations that are destroying opportunities for the disadvantaged, which is creating this two-tiered system we're headed for, which is destroying opportunities for the disadvantaged and creating welfare for the wealthy. But the best we can, what we do is focus on creating value for others. And how do we do that? We do it by trying to produce products and services that our customers will value more than their alternatives, and not just their alternatives today, but what the alternatives will be in the future. We try to more efficiently use resources than our competitors and constantly improve in that. And we try to do the best job we can in creating a safe environment and environmental excellence.
I need to back you up to that whole corporate welfare and the state of society today, because that's in essence what you're talking about with people who are advantaged and disadvantaged. It's not possible that you don't see that Koch Industries has benefited from some of those policies that the government has in place today.
Oh, terrific. I mean, you can't help. I mean, you're hurt by some and benefit by others. I mean, look at all the forms of corporate welfare. There are cash subsidies, there are loan guarantees, there are import tariffs, there are regulations on your competitors.
Right, and my point is that Koch Industries benefits from all of those.
Well, I mean, some cases we benefit, some we're hurt, but we're opposed to all of them, whether we benefit or whether we're hurt by them.
Full stop.
All of them. We oppose all of them.
Does government do any good in the economy?
Yeah, the government, in my definition, is the agency that has the legal monopoly of force. And you say, well, God, that's bad. No, we need force to protect the U.S. from attack, to protect people's person and property. And in certain other things, when force works better than voluntary cooperation and competition. And so that, to me, is the test. But the government has gone way over in using force, and we see that in the criminal justice system, where we have 5% of the world population and 25% of the world's prison population. Now, obviously, we're using a lot more force than other countries we look down on, and so that's why we're working at that. Then using force, using regulations to keep the disadvantaged from starting a small business or even getting a job. And one of the biggest of that is occupational licensure.
Let me ask you, though, whether you understand that people look at you and Koch Industries and say, well, of course he wants government out of the way because he's ginormous and he can steamroll us and do whatever he wants.
Well, if that's so, why are we about the only large company that's taking this position? Most companies want free enterprise in general, because that produces better goods and services and make people's lives better, but they don't want it in their business. They want protection from competition. They want subsidies. They want the government to pick winners and losers, and they want to be picked as winners. And that's what we're opposing. And that's what drives my whole efforts in policy and in the political arena.
So before we move on, I want to make sure I understand. If all government support for oil and gas industries, which is what this company was built on, or all
government... Well, not totally, but in part.
In part, okay.
That's how it started.
Exactly. So support for oil and gas industries, support for lumber and timber and paper products, which this company now owns with Georgia Pacific. If that all went away tomorrow, you'd be all right.
Absolutely. We oppose all of it. Go back to what I said, our basic philosophy to succeed long term, it's to dedicate yourself to creating value for others, to helping other people improve their lives. And that isn't altruistic. That's the way we believe we all do better. Because for a business to survive over a long period, it needs to be contributing to society and people's well-being. Otherwise, who's going to want it? Otherwise, you end up like Enron or some of these other companies.
I wonder whether your definition of society's well-being isn't necessarily everybody's definition of society's well-being. You've got your view here from this very successful large company that you run.
But that's not where my view came from the company. The way I run the company came from my study across all relevant disciplines from all different perspectives over a year on how people can best live and work together to make their lives better.
You have a management philosophy you lay out in this book called market-based management,
correct,
which you credit almost entirely for the success of this company and the growth, right?
Well, I wouldn't say entirely, but it's been a key part.
Fair enough. I wonder, as you look at those principles that you lay out in this book, where risk tolerance falls on your spectrum of things you consider, because you started in a very risky business, oil and gas.
Well, by the time I came, our main business was crude oil gathering mm-hmm. in southern Oklahoma. And so besides running this equipment company, my main objective was to build that up. And we built that from being in southern Oklahoma to being the largest crude oil gatherer in the U.S. and Canada by applying many of these principles. But, I mean, that's the key. That's a great question. My philosophy, one of the biggest enemies of future success is past success, because you become complacent, you become risk averse. And that's one of the things we try to drive here, and this is fundamental to this philosophy. And that's in this component change and also in value creation, that we need to drive creative destruction, not just incremental innovations, but innovations that will change the whole nature of the business. And we're working on two now. One is, or a whole series of them, in biotechnology, and another in making smart products and processes, because we see these technologies coming to the point that they're going to transform industries, and we want to be the ones leading the transformation rather than be pushed aside because of.
Is it fair to say that you run this place a little bit like a startup? You talk a lot about creative destruction and being aggressive and innovating and not being afraid of failure. A little startup mentality?
Well, yeah, and fear of failure.
Yeah.
That if we're complacent, that the only way to succeed over time is not only create more value for your customers and in society than others today, but in the future. So we have to innovate and improve faster than not only existing competitors, but new entries, people with new ways of doing things. So we're leading in innovation.
You talk a lot in this book about doubling profits in this company every 6 years,
yeah,
right?
Average over time. Yeah.
Growing, growing, growing. Why do you have to grow? Why do you have to get bigger?
Well, because you either go forward or you go backward. And that goes the same philosophy as why we put so much weight, not just on incremental innovation, but on creative destruction, changing the whole nature of industries, bringing in new products that will radically change. I mean, for example, we're investing tremendously in a number of different aspects of biotechnology. And one is to make chemicals through biotechnology rather than through chemical processes. And in these, you consume CO2 rather than produce CO2 as a byproduct. And we believe from the laboratory in some of these chemicals, we can make at half the cost in a much more environmentally friendly way.
I wonder what you think of the current startup culture in American business today, with Silicon Valley and things going on in the sort of grassroots of this economy. You see yourself in there a little bit?
Well, we try to be, absolutely. I think innovations that will make people's lives better, like with Uber, that is great.
But have you ever taken an Uber?
No.
Oh. You ought to try it. It works sometimes. It works not so well sometimes.
Well, yeah, no, nothing's perfect. But it seems to work better than regular taxi cabs, because it's gaining, and all the taxi cab owners are trying to fight them and shut them down. So that's...
Is that your measure of success then? If the established order is fighting you, you're doing something right?
Well, we would hope not. But that's when you bring in a new innovation that threatens their business, that's what they try to do. They try to get government to shut you down. And that's one of the things that's, I think, is crippling the country and corrupting the business community. For example, because of these kind of initiatives, the U.S. has slipped to 46th in the world in ease of starting a business. It used to be one of the easiest. And it's because of these innovations threatening people. And also, I think is also an indication of that, is the median income in this country has dropped over the last 8 years. And I'm not blaming any party. Both parties are guilty of this. I believe that both parties are taking us down the road to serfdom, creating this two-tiered system and heading us toward a financial crisis. But the Democrats are doing it at 100 miles an hour, and the Republicans are only doing it 70 miles an hour.
Okay, so what's the difference? Arbitrage that for me, that 30 miles an hour difference. What's in there that makes it different?
Well, I think the Republicans will, they're almost as big as on corporate welfare. That would be very close, each one. But on some issues, on free trade and some of these things, the Republicans are somewhat better.
It's worth a note here that you have written not all that long ago, you know, 20, 30 years ago, if this is our only hope, you said this of the GOP, if this is our only hope, we're doomed.
That's right.
And still believe that?
Yeah, that's why, although our seminar group contributes quite a bit, political.
So these are the seminars you run twice a year
for
largely Republican donors.
Yeah, but yeah. My personal money, almost all of it goes into research and education, criminal justice reform, opposing poverty-creating regulations, supplementing the public education system so disadvantaged kids can learn the skills and values required for success that I had the benefit because my parents taught me those. And we want to give every kid that opportunity.
We should be clear here, though, that your personal money is not the same as the money that the Koch brothers, and I'm saying this with air quotes, spend on politics in America today.
Yeah, and that's, see, the overwhelming majority of that is what people who attend our seminars want to give to. They have, I'd say, our typical seminar participant has a lot more faith in politicians reversing the trajectory of this country toward this two-tiered system
than we do. Okay, so
I give some, and it's still a lot of money. But as a percentage of what I give, it's a very small percent.
Fair enough. But why do you spend so much money in politics if you fundamentally don't believe that the mechanism is working? Because I will tell you, and as you know, you are, to those who disagree with you in politics today, you are pretty much Darth Vader.
Oh, yeah. Right? That's why I get all the death threats.
No, I know you do. I know you do. And that's a serious issue. But you have become the symbol of the political right in this country, the secretive political right.
Right. And we're trying not to, I mean, and this is one reason I don't like politics.
That's such a remarkable thing to hear you say.
It's so dishonest. I mean, it's spin. This is why Hayek wrote the essay, Why the Worst Get to the Top in
Friedrich
Politics.
Hayek, very famous economist.
Nobel laureate. Yep. He was also a good friend. He was a wonderful person. In his book, Road to Serfdom, he wrote one of his essays in there. One of the chapters was Why the Worst Get to the Top in Politics. Because it's spin. If the politician tells people the truth, here's what you got to do. You got to work hard. You got to make a contribution to society. We can't have everybody trying to get what they can from the government and put the burden on other people. We've got to have people thinking, how do I contribute and then want to share of the value I'm creating for others? So it's win-win. It's a system of mutual benefit. And that's what we're pushing for. And that's what Hayek, back in the 40s, when he wrote that book, had the insight about.
So if you feel that way, and if you're spending, the Koch brothers, writ large, are spending so much money on politics, reports are $900 million in the 2016
cycle. No, but see, that's totally wrong.
Okay, what's the number?
Okay, here's the, and this is a budget, and it's a projection of what the donors want to give to. Because we say, okay, here are all the things that can be done that may or may not make a difference. And our latest budget is going to be lower because people aren't contributing
as much. Sir?
Probably the total budget over the 2 years, I would guess, would be $750, and the amount in politics is $250.
In millions of dollars.
And as I said, a very small portion of that $250 comes from the so-called Koch brothers, and even less from me than from my brother, because everybody can choose what they want to give to. So it isn't the Koch brothers doing it. It's other people doing it.
You realize that comes across as sort of disingenuous, right?
In what way? It's the truth.
You organize seminars. You fund grassroots organizations.
Yeah.
You have money in politics throughout the system. And for you to sit there and say, I'm sorry, this isn't really us, doesn't ring true and will not ring true when people hear this interview.
Okay. But here's the thing. If this wasn't what people wanted, other people wanted to give to, the money wouldn't come because we're not putting it up. You can say, yeah, we've improved the capability because we say, okay, if you want to donate to these, we need to help make it more effective and to try to pick better candidates who will do somewhat, maybe not go 70 miles an hour, and then hope there's a few who will agree and actually try to change the trajectory of the country.
So how do you figure out your return on investment for the money that you and those who think like you invest in politics in America today? Because as you know, the electoral cycle, the past couple of cycles, has not been really kind to Republicans.
Well, that's not true. In the off years, it has.
Sure. But last time there was a race for the White House, Karl Rove is the guy who stood up and said, what are we doing? We're wasting all this money.
Yeah. A lot of it is waste. I'll give you a stronger example to make your case.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Waste. And that is there's a tax bill that comes up every year. Has 55 different subsidies called the extenders.
Must make you crazy.
And, so we contributed to a bunch of the Congress people's campaigns. And so we wrote a letter to every congressperson, please vote this down. This is a whole series of subsidies to things like making movies in an area, just one boondoggle after the other. Mm-hmm. Please vote against this. Out of all the Republicans, close to 250, only 46 voted against it. Okay, so we're going to be looking harder at which Republicans we support or Democrats. I'm happy to support Democrats. We work with the White House on criminal justice reform.
I know you did, and the president gave you a shout-out in a speech a number of months ago.
Yeah, and we work with Van Jones. Mm-hmm. As Frederick Douglass say, I will work with anybody to do good and no one to do harm. Now, the question is, some of the people we've supported question whether they're doing more good than harm. And so we're going to do much more thorough analysis and learn from this. I talked about experimental discovery,
yes, sir,
creative destruction. We're going to be applying that in this arena as well.
How come you guys are so secretive?
How am I secretive? I'm here talking to you.
You are here talking to me, and I appreciate it. And I'll tell you what, you are everywhere lately, right? CBS Sunday Morning. You guys are in Popular Mechanics, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
So clearly, whoever's doing your PR is doing a great job. But over the past decade, plus or minus, since 2003 and starting the seminars, you have made an art of not letting yourself be known in the public arena. How come?
Well, see, I always believe what the mother whale told the baby whale. She said, son, the time you get harpooned is when you come up to spout off. So I followed that, and I followed it too long because for a long time, people didn't know who we are. And I've been working in this arena for over 50 years, and for the first 40, we didn't get into politics, so we didn't have this. Then in 2003, because of what the Bush administration was doing, we said, gosh, we've got to get involved in politics.
So let's be clear. That's George W. Bush, a Republican president who's doing things you didn't like, growing government and
increasing
all of that.
Destructive regulations, which led to the Great Recession, mm-hmm. Getting us in wars that were counterproductive, and so on. So, because in his campaign, he said a lot of things we could agree with, but then the actual practice was so different, and that's what we find with politician after politician.
Can you trust any of them?
Well, yeah, I think there's a few percent.
A few? Some small number?
A few percent. So that's what I say. We've got to narrow our focus and not be supporting so many. And so, I mean, it's like in business. We learn, we make mistakes. It isn't going the way we want, so we're going to change.
If your preferred candidate wins whatever race you're in and you have a chance to carry the day, what does this economy look like once Charles Koch is done with it? For example, you're going to get rid of corporate welfare, tax breaks, regulations, loopholes, all this. What about aid for the poor and disadvantaged? What are you going to do with that?
Well, I mean, I think there'll be a lot less poverty and a lot less disadvantage.
Because you would stop aid programs?
No. Well, I mean,
like welfare and supplemental nutrition
let's go back through welfare. When LBJ started the War on Poverty in 1965, his goal was to get rid of the dole. As these are his words, I want to get rid of the dole and turn tax eaters into taxpayers. Okay, that's our goal. But now we've spent over $20 trillion since then on the war on poverty, and the poverty level's the same. So this isn't working. So we need to reform it so it doesn't create these obstacles to the disadvantaged becoming productive, contributing citizens and just sit there on the dole. And I don't believe for a minute people want that. They say, well, people are lazy. Yeah, because you block all opportunities. They smoke a joint and they go to prison and they can't get a job. They're ruined. Whereas we have a president who smoked a joint and he becomes president. We have a candidate who says he smoked a joint. He's running for president. Now, what's the equity? What's the fairness in that? We need to get rid of those distinctions and those differences in opportunity. And then we need to teach these kids the values and skills required for success. Now, there will still be some who can't make it. So there needs to be a safety net. Now, the question is, what's the balance between force, which our current welfare system is based on, and voluntary cooperation and competition? I would argue we have too much force, just like we do in the criminal justice system. And it needs to be a balance, and we need to use local knowledge. That is, are all these so-called benefits, are they helping people or hurting them? They're probably helping some, and they're hurting others because they have a disincentive to work. And as I learned, unless you start working, if you're frozen out of work, you will never learn the habits, the discipline, the values of cooperation and improvement unless you get a job. And that's what statistics show. Unless you get a job and keep it, you will not get out of poverty. If you do, you have a very good chance of working out of poverty. So that's, we want the emphasis more on education and opportunity than dole, just like Lyndon Johnson wanted. Now, exactly how to do it, we don't have all the answers, but we think directionally we know that what's been done in large part isn't working. But there still needs to be a safety net.
This is one of those questions that I know before I ask it, you're not going to answer. But who do you like for the White House in 2016?
I don't know. I would like somebody who's going to change the trajectory of the country rather than take us down this same road we're on at 70 miles an hour or 85 versus 100. I mean that's some benefit, but we need somebody who will come in and really deal with these fundamental problems that are keeping the country back from the potential. With all the technologies out there now, we have the potential to have the best lives for everybody than anybody ever dreamed of.
But wait, warts and all, and there are many of them in this society and economy, we are, by any measure you can think of, the richest, most powerful society in the history of the planet. Is that not good enough for you?
Well, no, we're not the richest anymore or have the most benefit. I mean, other places do. Other places are freer and so on. on the...
But sir, come on. That just doesn't stand up to reason.
Well, it's true. We don't have the highest median income, which, as I said, has gone down. Uh-huh. We don't have the most economic freedom. We were, before the Bush administration, we were third. Now we've dropped, depending on which measure, to 16th. And that correlates very well with prosperity. Doesn't that bother you that the median income and the income of the least advantage is going down? That you're okay with that? I'm not. That's what I want to change.
Median income in this country is $53,000 a year, plus or minus. What do you think the person making $53,000 a year in this country feels like economy-wise? How do you think their economy feels to them?
Well, if you believe the polls about is the country going to be better for my children than me, the majority say it's not, which up until a few years ago, that wasn't the case. You look at the candidates they want. And they're for Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, Carson, and so on, people who are non-politicians. People want to change. They do not like the direction the country's going, and neither do I, for the very reasons I've been describing.
Can you foresee a day when you will not be involved in policy and politics in this country?
Oh, yeah. I'm an old guy.
Yeah, but here you are still running a $100 billion company and working 9 hours a day and going to the employee cafeteria when you don't have to.
Well, I work more than 9 hours a day. Come on. Don't give me short shrift here. All right, Come on. But, what do you think? I'm a slacker?
Well, so that's the question. Here you are almost 80 years old. You don't have to do this anymore.
No, of course not. But I do it because I feel a moral obligation to use whatever abilities I have to try to make things better, both in our company and in society. You don't have to agree with me, and it doesn't matter to me, because what counts to me is that I'm doing the best I can by my own standards. I mean, I feel a little bit like probably Martin Luther did when he was on trial, and he said,
Martin Luther.
Yeah, here I stand, I can do no other. I mean, if I weren't doing the things I'm doing and I see what's going on, I would be so frustrated I'd probably explode or have a heart attack. But since I'm doing everything I know how, and is it all good? Does it all work? No, as you pointed out, there are a lot of problems with it. We got a lot to learn. We got a lot of improvements to make, and that's what I'm working on. But I feel I'm doing everything I can, the best I can, and that's all I can do. So when I'm on my deathbed, that's what I want to be able to say. I did the best I could. I made a lot of mistakes. I screwed up a lot, but I did the best I could, and that's all I can ask of myself. That's all anybody can ask of his or herself.
The idea that you're okay with people disagreeing with you, which hopefully we all are. Do you think it's possible for us to have an honest discourse when you have the means to so heavily influence the debate?
I don't see. I would like to more heavily. What? Because I would like people to...
No, come on.
No, absolutely. You look at the Republican debate. Do you see the things I've been talking about in the debate? You see people saying these things that I'm saying? No.
No, sir, I don't.
So how am I influencing the debate? I mean, when we've talked to the politicians...
So you're wasting your money.
Yeah. Well, we haven't put any money into...
Fine.
So, I mean, we've learned that we need to see who has some chance of trying to make a difference rather than just going with the flow and going right down the stream over the cliff.
You run an enormous company. You have a large public profile, for as much as you've tried not to. Does that help you or hurt you in running this business?
Well, I'll put it this way. It certainly helped me in selling books. I mean, we had a hard time getting a publisher. We could only get one. Now, on this one, we had many publishers want it, not because of me, but because of all the attention. They knew it would sell much better. I think the same thing is true. I mean, there are boycotts on us and stuff. We can't tell anyone. I think for every person who boycotts us, there are probably two or three that want to buy our products because they know what we stand for.
Why are you still in Wichita, Kansas? I mean, you could have long ago picked Koch Industries up and moved them anywhere.
Why? We're very successful here.
Fair point.
I mean, this is a place, a great place to be. I mean, there aren't a lot of distractions. There's not an ocean. There are not mountains. Here.
I guess that's a positive.
Here, sure. No. Here, people work. There's a great work ethic here. And we recruit from colleges where they have kids that grew up the way I did, having to work all the time. It may not have been because I had the father I did, but because they lived on a farm. And if you didn't milk the cows, you don't have any milk. If you don't sow the seeds and bring in the crop, you have no income. So you have to work. And so there's not this sense of entitlement. There's a work ethic and a realization that if you want to get somewhere, you've got to create value. You've got to do something productive.
Is it true you still live in the same house you built in 1973?
Yeah, same house. It's great. It's much bigger than I wanted, but my wife...
You lost that argument?
My wife took charge. Matter of fact, we had dug the foundation and we were having terrible problems. The whole...
This is 73, the Arab oil embargo, right?
Yeah. Oil embargo, all the prices, markets turned upside down. We had price controls. I mean, it was... I thought we were going to go broke. And I remember sitting there with my legs hanging over into the hole in the ground, saying, honey, we got the money to fill this thing back up, but I don't think we've got the money to finish it. Because I thought we had a good shot of going broke with the way things were going. But we got through it. But as Lennon said, you learn through struggle. And so
was that Charles Koch just quoting Lennon? Did that just happen?
I quote all sorts of people.
Wow. That's pretty good. We started with your dad. Let me end with your dad. Let's say he comes back to life and walks into Wichita 2015 and comes to the Koch Tower here on the campus. What does he say to you?
He'll say, holy mackerel. No, but I'm the same way. As I've said, when I first came with the company, being mathematical, I said, okay, if I can implement my ideas here, here's how much I think we can grow. And I plotted that out till my retirement. And 2 years ago, we exceeded my lifetime goal by 70-fold. So I can't believe it. So it's way beyond my expectation. As I like to say, it's better to be lucky than smart. So I did the best I could, and it worked out beyond anything I believed possible.
Charles Koch, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
There you go. He is a tough old son of a gun, Charles Koch is. He likes a good debate, a good discussion, a good argument, even you could say. He also gave us some great photos of his childhood, his family as well. There's even that letter from his father that he mentioned. It's all on our website, marketplace.org. And we will be back next month with another installment of Corner Office. In the meanwhile, check out that radio show we do every day on a public radio station near you. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thanks a bunch for being here. This is APM.